Biden the recent riots in the country. People across Iran take to the streets to condemn Wednesday's terrorist attack on a southern shrine that left 13 people dead. And Russia announces end of mobilization of 300,000 reservists to fight in Ukraine. Thank you for joining us. Iran says it's in possession of, quote, irrefutable documents proving that the U.S. was the chief architect of the recent riots in the country. In a statement, Iran's intelligence ministry and the intelligence organization of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps said the U.K., Israel, and Saudi spy agencies also colluded in the plot. The statement added that the plans were hatched prior to the riots to create a nationwide crisis in Iran. It said the ultimate aim of the plot was to, quote, commit crimes against the Iranian nation, violate Iran's territorial integrity, and pave the ground for further foreign pressure against the country. The two Iranian intelligence organizations also said despite the claims of the current U.S. administration, it's continuing and even intensifying the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. The statement said the U.S. is also targeting the social fabric in Iran by trying to polarize the nation. Political commentator Mohammad Ali Araki tells us how the U.S. and its allies foment unrest to overthrow governments that do not toe their line.
The statement that has been issued by the Islamic Republic of Iran officials is a very precise and clear statement. The United States of America and its allies around the world believe in an idea called organic uprisings. Now, it's not as honest as it looks, organic uprisings. What they want to do is they look to overthrow governments that are not in line with their benefits. And the Islamic Republic of Iran and its allies in the Middle East and around the world are an example of those governments. So therefore, what they do is they try to start protests that when you look at it from outside, when you zoom back, it looks like, yes, there are people here, they disagree with their government. But in fact, the reality is that the United States of America and all the intelligence services that they are working closely with, they are the ones behind this. And this can clearly be seen in the events that started from Mahsa Amini ongoing to the recent terrorist attacks that occurred in Shiraz. And it is important for me to mention that these will not end here. They will keep on trying, but they will fail in the end, and they will not reach the target that they wish to reach.
Iranians from different walks of life have taken to the streets to condemn the terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz, which left 13 people dead and dozens injured. Saman Khojouri reports.
Iranians have held nationwide rallies to condemn the Wednesday terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz. The protesters took to the streets in different cities following Friday prayers. They chanted slogans and held banners, calling for the perpetrators and their backers to be brought to justice.
Today we're here to show the world that we are all together. We are a powerful country. We're going to fight against terrorism. We're going to fight against violence. You want us to be separated. You want us to fight against each other, but we are the one. We are powerful.
At least 13 people, including two children, were killed after gunmen opened fire on pilgrims at the Shah Cheragh Holy Shrine in Shiraz. 26 others were wounded. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility shortly after the attack.
We strongly condemn any acts of terrorism and desecration of Muslim sanctities. We want to say that we hate London-based news channels like Iran International, Manoto, and BBC because they are instigating violence and unrest in Iran.
We are here to send this message to Israel, the U.S., and their allies that through creating riots and unrest in the country, they cannot achieve their sinister goal of disintegration of Iran. We are united.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on security agencies, the judiciary, intellectuals, activists, and the entire nation to act in unison to confront the current which is disregarding and disrespecting people's lives, security, and sanctities. Meanwhile, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has also vowed that the Islamic Republic would deliver a crushing response to those who were behind the bloodshed.
The ralliers have called on Iranian authorities to prosecute the main perpetrators of the heinous crime of terrorist attack in Shiraz and take all necessary measures to maintain security in the country as soon as possible. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Political commentator Fawad Izadi tells us why meddlesome U.S. policies will once again fail in Iran.
Western intelligence services have infiltrated ISIS and ISIS-linked groups for many, many years. And they utilize these groups to achieve foreign policy goals. You know, the terrorist attack in Shiraz happened on the 40th day of passing of Mahsa Amini. So this is a way of showing support for the riots in Iran. But this is a terrorist organization. So you know, instead of just issuing a statement, they engage in some sort of terrorist activity, killing 15 innocent people at the shrine. So overall, I think when these type of things happen, Iranians realize what's going on. Majority of people in Iran are used to this type of American scheme. They know all about color revolution and the different tactics that Americans use to orchestrate color revolution. And this is going to backfire. And what you see in demonstrations today is basically the backfire that is expected from the Iranian people. And so the Americans are going to fail once again when it comes to their Iran policy.
Iran's foreign minister once again dismisses allegations that it has provided drones to Russia to use in the war against Ukraine. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Tehran's policy regarding the war in Ukraine is refraining from sending weapons to the warring parties. He made the comments in a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart. The foreign minister also said Tehran respects the territorial integrity of countries and seeks the cessation of the war and the displacement of people. He called for Ukrainian officials to avoid the influence of some extremist European politicians. Amir Abdullahian also expressed Iran's readiness to hold technical meetings with Ukrainian military experts on the issue of drones. For his part, Dmitry Kuleba welcomed Iran's stance and highlighted the importance of technical military talks between the two countries. Russia's defense minister says partial mobilization of 300,000 reservists to fight in Ukraine is now complete. Sergei Shoigu says over a quarter of the draftees have been deployed in the battlefield. He stressed that no additional mobilization is planned for now. This is the first mobilization of reservists by Russia since World War II. The Russian president ordered the call-up in September after he approved annexation of four eastern and southern Ukrainian regions. Ukraine's president Volodymyr Zelensky has expressed doubt that the call-up is finished. It says Moscow may need to send new soldiers to the conflict very soon. Ukraine and NATO countries continue to claim Crimea as part of Ukraine despite a referendum there on joining Russia in 2014. Our correspondent Johnny Miller reports on the views of people on the peninsula.
The elegant streets of historic Sevastopol. Ukraine and NATO still claim this city and the rest of Crimea as part of Ukraine, despite the 2014 referendum on joining Russia. Down by the harbor, I wanted to know how people feel about Ukrainian threats of taking back this city.
Crimea is not baggage to transfer in and out. People don't want to return to Ukraine, and they never identified as Ukrainian.
I don't want Crimea to return to Ukraine. We are Russian. We speak Russian. We were raised as Russian, and we have Russian culture. I was born in 1986, and never in my life did I feel myself Ukrainian. I have Ukrainian citizenship, but all my life I considered myself Russian and living in a Russian city.
My personal opinion was Crimea was Russian and remains Russia. I'm an ordinary man and this is my opinion. It will be bad if someone wants to take away Crimea. but I'm against the war that is going on. It's terrible what is going on in my beloved Russia.
A Russian fighter jet flies overhead, a common occurrence, perhaps returning from a combat mission in Kherson. Sometimes cruise missiles can be seen from the harbour, fired by Russia's Black Sea Fleet, which is based in the city.
Let them dream. It's not harmful to dream. We are at home. Nobody asked our opinion when Crimea became part of Ukraine. We were forced to become Ukrainian citizens. 30 years later, we returned home. We were tormented and were worried. Ukrainians were treating us badly. Everyone here is Russian.
Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine in 1954. Many see that as a historic mistake, not reflective of the wishes of locals.
Now, I have found a couple of people who are more pro-Ukrainian. They don't want to say their views openly, and they do tend to be from a younger demographic born after the fall of the Soviet Union. But even amongst that age group, they are very much in the minority.
So Ukraine and NATO say that they want to take back Crimea from Russia. How do you feel about that?
I wish you good luck. Let's try. They can try, but they won't at all. It's a Russian place. What can I say more?
So, we are Russians.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to claim this city as their own, one thing is not in doubt. The vast majority of people living here want to be part of the Russian Federation. Chernomyl, Sevastopol, Crimea.
10,000 jobs are at risk in southern Italy as a refinery will be hit by an embargo on Russian oil that kicks in a few weeks. Meanwhile, the Italian government is working on ways to keep the plant owned by Russian corporation Lukoil in business. Our reporter in Rome, Max Civelli, has more for us in this report.
Earlier this month, Brussels approved the 8th round of sanctions on Russia over the conflict in Ukraine in an attempt to deprive Moscow of billions of euros in revenues from selling products in the European Union. In a previous round of sanctions, the 6th, Brussels had approved an embargo on Russian seaborne oil that will come into force on December the 5th. This punitive measure will severely affect the Isab refinery, located on Sicily Island in the south of Italy. The refinery, owned by the Russian multinational energy corporation Lukoil, used to buy about 40% of its feedstock from Moscow. Due to the embargo, the plant could shut down in a few weeks, leaving thousands of people jobless.
These workers have been on permanent employment contracts for many years. They are very worried about what lies ahead. A closure of the refinery would reverberate on the region's satellite activities, affecting about 10,000 workers. We have received assurances from the new government that a positive solution will be found.
Although Lukoil was not singled out by EU sanctions, the Isab plant, which accounts for around 20% of Italian refining capacity, has been forced to rely solely on Russian oil since international banks are no longer providing the refinery with credit to buy oil from alternative suppliers.
Per quanto riguarda queste sanzioni sul petrolio,
EU financial sanctions usually contain derogation provisions which allow competent authorities to authorize activities that would otherwise be prohibited. These provisions should be immediately applied to the Isab refinery case. This embargo on Russian oil will only have the consequence of further damaging the EU's energy market.
A last shipment of Russian oil is expected to reach the Isab refinery by December the 5th. The Italian government has a bit over a month to find a solution to the issue. There seems to be two ways only to avert the closure of the Isab plant. Either the refinery gets nationalized and the Italian government is reportedly mulling over this option, or it is sold to non-Russian buyers. Some media have reported that US private equity fund Crossbridge is among parties interested in buying the refinery. Actually, there is also a third option that could work for ISAB. Continue the same way as today. But that would imply a normalization of ties between the EU and Russia, an option that seems non-viable at this stage. Max Civelli, Rome.
After more than a decade of on and off indirect talks, Lebanon and Israel have signed a U.S.-mediated deal to end their maritime dispute. The agreement will allow Lebanon to exploit its own natural resources. Our correspondent Mariam Salah has more in this report.
Lebanon and Israel have finalized a U.S.-brokered deal aimed at resolving a maritime dispute. President Michel Aoun signed a letter on Thursday endorsing the agreement. The final paperwork was submitted to the United Nations in Naqoura, southern Lebanon, concluding a long path of indirect negotiations with the Israeli regime. Separately, the Israeli cabinet, led by Prime Minister Yair Lapid, also approved the agreement. The regime's representative then delivered the signed copy to the UN at the Naqoura point. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. Nasrallah also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue. The Hezbollah leader said the agreement is not an international treaty.
What happened in Naqoura is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein, who was with the Lebanese delegation in the southern Lebanese town of Naqoura, had met the top Lebanese officials.
I truly believe and hope that this can be an economic turning point in Lebanon for a new era of investment and continued support to lift up the economy and make sure that whatever arrangements happen, they're done openly, transparently, and making sure that the benefits are felt directly by all the Lebanese people.
Experts believe this agreement would put Lebanon on the map of natural gas exporters. President Michel Aoun stressed in a statement that demarcating the southern maritime border is a technical matter that has no political implications and won't change his country's policy towards the Israeli regime. U.S. President Joe Biden has hailed the maritime border deal as a historic breakthrough. For Lebanon, it unlocks the possibility to exploit its own natural resources at a time when the West is seeking gas suppliers and looking for alternatives to Russian gas. Mariam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
And that's a wrap for this hour's World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Divisions within the UK Tory party are much more intense than those within other conservative parties in the West. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. RT in an op-ed wrote, like many Western conservative parties, the Tories are going through a period of deep division. Liz Truss was finally compelled to resign as UK Prime Minister late last week. The radical new era that she had promised to usher in had lasted a mere 45 days. Her downfall came as no surprise to observers of UK politics. Weeks ago, George Galloway told all who would listen that Truss was as thick as mince in a bottle, As the historian Dominic Sandbrook said, she was the least impressive person to have become prime minister in my lifetime, so it proved to be. Truss's cabinet was no better. Last week, Tory MP Charles Walker described them as talentless people, a charitable assessment under the circumstances. Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng proved to be just as inept as Truss, as there are simply no words at all to adequately describe Truss's Deputy Prime Minister Therese Coffey. Truss's exit from politics has only intensified the self-destructive divisions within the UK Tory party that caused Remainers and other elements of the party to depose Boris Johnson earlier this year. The crisis that is destroying the Tory party intensified dramatically on Sunday night when Johnson announced that he would not be a candidate in the Tory leadership contest, saying that you can't govern effectively unless you have a united party in Parliament. How did the Tory party come to be in the extraordinary position it now finds itself, crippled by internal divisions, completely bereft of competent leadership, internally ungovernable, and facing electoral annihilation at the next general election, whenever that may be held? The answer, in large part, lies in the economic revolution that has occurred in the global economy over the past 40 years. This revolution, which is still in progress, involves the transformation of the international economic order from one based on nation-states, industrial production, and fossil fuels to one based on global corporations, new technologies, and renewable energy sources. This economic revolution, as radically transformative as the first industrial revolution, has been led by a new set of global ruling elites who are rapidly replacing the older nation-state-based elites that had controlled the world order since the end of Second World War, if not before. As all revolutionary elites do, the new global elites formulate ideologies that legitimize the new economic and social order that they are creating. These include globalism, catastrophic climate change, identity politics, all forms of political correctness, and most recently, gender fluidity and rights. These new ideologies stand in stark contrast to those adhered to by the older nation-state-based elites. They believed in what used to be called traditional 19th century bourgeois values, including nationalism, patriotism, the traditional family, individual rights, the rule of law, Christianity, and work ethic. As the new global economic order and its rulers have progressively displaced the older economic system and its leaders, these antithetical ideologies have clashed with increasing bitterness and intensity. This ongoing conflict has been termed the culture wars by some historians. This clash of irreconcilable ideologies is still taking place in all Western nations. The precise form that it takes differs in each country, depending upon the history and cultural characteristics of each. At the same time, that economies and ideological beliefs in the West have undergone profound revolutionary change over the past 40 years, politics in liberal democracies have also been fundamentally transformed. In Western countries with two-party political systems, left-wing social democratic parties that once represented the interests of the industrial working class and middle-class progressives have now become parties representing the interests of the new globalized elites. Blair's Labour Party and Clinton's Democrat Party are classic examples of this transformation, which often involves a degree of conflict. Hence, Keir Starmer's recent battle with Jeremy Corbyn, who represented the old Labour Party and Hillary Clinton's conflict with Bernie Sanders, who is an old-style Democratic socialist, in Australia, the Labour Party has seamlessly made this transition in recent years. Once social democratic parties complete this kind of political transformation, they become ideologically unified to an extraordinary degree because they rigidly adhere to the beliefs of the new elites. Policy differences continue to exist, but deep-seated divisions disappear entirely. The UK Labour Party, for example, contains no equivalent of Tory culture warriors like Kemi Badenoch. With traditional conservative parties, however, the situation is very different. These parties tend to be unstable mixes of old and new elites because their economic interests coincide to a considerable degree. Many members of the old guard readily adapt themselves to the new global economic regime, in the same way that a significant segment of the 18th century French aristocracy sided with the bourgeoisie when the French Revolution broke out. But while elements of the old elites may easily adapt to the new global economic order, many find it much more difficult to adapt the ideological beliefs that are part and parcel of that economic order. Significant segments of conservative parties still represent the interests of the older elites, and more importantly, still firmly believe in traditional 19th century bourgeois values. That is why the ideological divisions within the conservative parties tend to be much more intense. Hence, why the ongoing bitter conflicts within the Tory party over Brexit, climate change, identity policies, and other rights, all key cultural walls issues, simply have no counterpart within the UK Labour Party. Divisions within the UK Tory party are much more intense than those within other conservative parties in the West, because only in the UK did the autonomy of the nation-state itself become a political issue. Because of former Tory PM David Cameron's disastrous decision to hold a referendum on Brexit. In America, since 1990s, the traditional Republican Party has transformed itself from a conservative party into a right-wing populist party, controlled by Donald Trump. That appeals to the older middle class and the traditional working class, which have been economically displaced by the new global economic order and abandoned politically by the Democrats. Where then does this leave the UK Tory party? A few things are tolerably clear. First, a Trump-style populist transformation of the Tory party in England was never on the cards. If a right-wing populist party is to emerge in the UK, it can only do so after the Conservative Party has ceased to exist. And second, the deep ideological divisions that have reduced it to a shambles are so deep-seated that they cannot be eradicated. Even Truss' embarrassing demise has not convinced her supporters. The rabid neoliberals that her policies were fundamentally flawed. The remainer wing of the party that was instrumental in deposing Johnson remains unrepentant, as do the right-wing culture warriors led by Badenoch. Also, Truth Out wrote, as so often in recent times, the Tory party has a new leader and therefore Britain a new prime minister. In the last leadership contest, Rishi Sunak managed to lose to the inept ideologue Liz Truss, who then, only weeks later, when challenged by a tabloid newspaper to at last a lettuce lost to the vegetable. How did the political script twist into this farce? How could former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, a figure so disgraced that he should be auditioning for pantomime villain roles in the run-up to Christmas, countenance a comeback, and why did he fall short? Why is Sunak so despised in the Tory party, and how did he nonetheless carry the day? What does his government represent, and how will the Labour Party respond? The trigger came when Truss' government attempted a Reagan-style borrowing binge. Truss was not the choice of her fellow Tory members of Parliament. Since 2001, a voice in some Tory leadership contests has been granted to party members. Their demographic is distinctive. Small in number, overwhelmingly old, white, male, bigoted, middle-class residents of southern England. In a word, out of touch. Their idol, Truss, promised Reaganite tax cuts for the wealthy plus Johnson style. Cake is populism. When it comes to cake, he is pro having it and pro eating it too. All this in a period of stagnation when central banks were raising interest rates. The sums didn't add up. Truss lost the support of capital in shape most immediately of currency and gilt traders. Sterling slumped to a record low against the dollar and the price of government debt soared. The fracture between capital and the party of capital under Truss had begun earlier. In the slipstream of 2008 Great Recession, the 2010s were years of despair and polarization. The rich were greatly enriched thanks to quantitative easing. Everyone else was subjected to austerity. Wages flatlined or declined and have still not recovered.
Food for thought.
Hello, friends, and let us ponder on a wise saying from the Holy Prophet's 11th infallible heir, Imam Hassan Askari, peace be upon him. Anger is the key to every evil.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to keep secrets. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of how to keep secrets in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic teachings, we see that secrets are important and everyone has some secrets in their life. Therefore, it is necessary to keep secrets when people are sharing their secrets with you. Maybe there is something which is not a secret, but someone does not like it to be shared. For example, when we talk about the backbiting has the similar concept that the things that a person does not like that someone talks about him in front of others or any issue or anything that you know about that person and he or she does not like it to be disclosed. So we need to keep that as a secret with us. Therefore, there must be some ways to how to keep these secrets. And therefore, we look at the Islamic texts. The first way is to choose a trustworthy person. If you want to convey your secret to someone, if you want to share your secret with someone, and you're willing to get some advice from that person, therefore, always and always choose a trustworthy person, a person who keeps the trust, who keeps the secrets. And whenever we give him anything, so he becomes the best trustee. So it is important to choose someone who is trustworthy, because if we do not do that, then obviously there is a harm. Obviously, there is a danger that the secret that I have, it might be disclosed. Therefore, it is necessary to choose someone who is trustworthy. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the ways of keeping the secrets. And one of the ways, the first way which we look at in the Islamic text was to choose someone who is reliable. In the narrations, it is known as a person who is thiqa or muwathaq. These are the words that we have even in the traditions, like the ahadith which are narrated by the prophets and the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salatu wassalam. We must see that at least the person who is narrating the things or the chain of narrators, in that all of them must be at least thiqa or muwathaq, which means reliable, a person who does not disclose the secrets, a person who does not lie with people, and you can rely, and he is a reliable person. Therefore, Imam Ali alayhi salam also has said, لا تدعن سرك إلا عند كل ثقة. Do not tell your secret to anyone except if he is a reliable person, if he is a trustworthy person, because in the other saying he said, wala tudi'anna sirraka man la amanata lahu. Do not give your secret to someone who does not keep the secrets or the trust of the people, who is not trustworthy, who is not reliable. Therefore, it is very important that we must give the secrets, we must tell about the secrets to someone who is trustworthy. And this is what we see actually in the life of the Ahlul Bayt as well, that whenever they had their secrets, they used to tell them to their special companions and not to everyone. Therefore, we have some special traditions, special things which are narrated in the Islam from the Ahlul Bayt, from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which was said to specific people who were trustworthy, who were reliable, who were truthful. And this is what Islam says, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
If you enjoy street art, then you'll probably like Iztapalapa district in Mexico's capital city. Nearly 300 neighborhoods in this area are beautifully painted with brightly colored murals for all to enjoy. Visitors can also ride a cable car and take a tour of the art from above. The district is home to nearly 7,000 murals and graffiti painted on all sorts of surfaces, including rooftops. Iztapalapa Murals is a project that was promoted by the Mexico City's mayor in 2018. The goal of the project was to recover and dignify public spaces through art and involve neighbors in its creation and conservation. Iztapalapa is one of the poorest municipalities in the capital, and the initiative aims to reduce neighborhood violence through public lighting of the murals during the night.
It is never too late to learn a new skill. That's what 100-year-old Nada Rudan has shown with her art when she discovered her love for painting at the age of 87. The Bosnian native says she started to paint to keep herself busy, and now she finds the days are often too short to fit in everything she wanted to do. The artist paints for 3 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon without glasses. Rudan marked her 100th birthday with an exhibition of all the works that she has painted over the years.
My 100th birthday, I've celebrated it at sea. That was really a big event for me. Before that, I had an exhibition that I didn't hope for. But my children persuaded me. I was against it. I'm not an artist. I said, children, don't embarrass me.
She says she's inspired by nature and her travel around the globe. Rudan has lived in numerous areas such as Central America, Hawaii Islands, Europe, and the Asian Himalayas, among many other places. The artist survived both World War II and the siege of Sarajevo by Bosnian Serb forces. Iran's Kish Island is known as the paradise of the Persian Gulf. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has been to the stunning southern Iranian resort island and has filed this report about its beautiful attractions.
It's no land at the heart of a scorching but amazing island. This snow town is one of the latest entertainment centers in Iran's Kish Island in the Persian Gulf. Every year, some 2 million visitors from inside and outside Iran visit the island to enjoy its attractions, from its entertainment centers to its stunning beach.
The beach and the pier in Kish are really peaceful and tranquilizing. It's the third time I'm visiting the island, and I went parasailing, water skiing, and I'm planning to go scuba diving.
Kish Island offers all kinds of sea entertainment activities, from scuba diving to sailing, and oh yes, flyboarding. Besides sea sports, visitors can enjoy its amusement parks and a range of leisure activities inside the island. And if you're a tireless window shopper, Kish is a land of malls and shopping centers.
Kish is an amazing island. It used to be an abandoned island some 3 decades ago, but today it is a luxurious tourist resort with modern buildings and exciting recreational places.
Despite all the pleasure one can have in Kish, the island still has many shortcomings. The major issue annoying visitors is the poor accommodation services.
Hotel facilities and services are a bit weak given the large number of tourists that visit this island. They need to pay more attention to the accommodation infrastructure.
Just a few hundred kilometers away from Kish, there's a tourist magnet in the United Arab Emirates, Dubai, which absorbs the chunk of foreign tourists. While U.S. sanctions on Iran are a major factor to blame for Kish lagging behind in its rivalry with Dubai, the island's officials believe it still has a chance to win the game of tourism against Dubai.
If we want to excel, it is not going to be a tough job. We need to work on two major areas. The first is the infrastructure, and the second is regulations that would allow tourists or investors to easily come to Kish to entertain themselves or do business.
Situated off the southern coast of Iran in the Persian Gulf, Kish is one of Iran's free trade zones. Foreign travelers do not need a visa to visit the island, as travel permits are issued on arrival by Kish officials and are valid for up to 14 days.
With its mesmerizing nature and eye-catching urban landscapes, Kish has earned the title of the Bride of the Persian Gulf. Its authorities say the island is already a hub for Iranian travelers, but they say they seek to turn it into a regional tourist magnet. Yusuf Jalali from Kish Island.
A 78-year-old artist is making a comeback with a unique art installation on Governor's Island in the United States of America. One of its biggest features is the sound and creaking of moving chains.
It's a project that I proposed for a commission in St. Louis. The site of the commission was the area near the Mississippi River and the St. Louis courthouse. So I wanted to do a piece that addressed those areas and the subjects. And and of course we have in those areas the Mississippi River, which is a place that you talk about the history of American commerce, but also we can talk about the history of slavery.
Charles Gaines wanted to highlight the role slavery played in building the economy of the United States. That's why he purposely used chains, and the sculptor pointedly faces the Statue of Liberty in New York City. The installation is roughly 30 meters long and activated by colossal chains that rotate on anchors. The installation is part of a three-chapter series called The American Manifest, Moving Chains. It will be kept for all to see until the summer of next year.
A Palestinian farmer has discovered an ancient Byzantine-era mosaic when preparing to plant an olive tree on his plot of land in the Gaza Strip. The farmer and his son have been carefully excavating the area for 3 months since spring. The pair dug out three patches, revealing glimpses of an ornate mosaic with intricate images of birds, flora, and tile patterns. Its full size is roughly 23 square meters. The discovery has set off excitement amongst archaeologists. Experts say it is one of the most well-preserved specimens, with precision in graphics and richness in colors. According to archaeologists, the mosaic pavement dates back to the 5th and 7th centuries. Last month, another Palestinian farmer found the rare stone sculpture while working on his land, which dates back to around 2500 BC.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
If you have a sweet tooth, then this next bit of news is just for you. Visitors are now taking advantage of the expanded version of Cakeland, which is an immersive art gallery in the U.S. city of Los Angeles. The structure is meant to feel like a giant multi-layered cake. It's entirely made of artificial materials but looks like if it's full of cherries, whipped cream, and layers of cake. Artist Scott Hoff says he used nearly a ton of pipe frosting, 120 mirrors, and thousands of cherries. Plus, he embedded thousands of crystals in the walls as a final touch. The artist says he chose to develop cake land after he noticed how much his artificial cake sculptures were welcomed by viewers.
So I chose cake because, number one, it's really beautiful. Number two, it's really fun to do. And number three, it engages the viewers in such a meaningful way.
Hoff says he never actually made a real cake before and has mainly followed his enthusiasm for fake food as the inspiration for this project. Visitors are able to walk through the cake, a labyrinth, and explore various rooms. While there is a lot of deliciousness and lightness of the cakes, visitors to this cake land can discover some interesting darker elements as they wander around. The art installation has continued to expand since it was founded by Hov in 2020. Robots are slowly but surely becoming part of everyday life, taking on human roles in different areas. Now, fast food restaurants can make French fries faster and better as a robot called Flippy 2 takes over the job.
When an order comes in through the restaurant system, it automatically spits out the instructions to Flippy. It takes a frozen product, fries it for the precise amount of time, and puts the finished product in the end. It does it faster, more accurately, more reliably, and happier than most humans do it.
Flippy 2 has been created in a robotic lab in California called MISO after 5 years of efforts by its developers. According to the project engineers, a really good understanding of the food science is needed to make sure the food quality is there, how different food sticks together, and how the temperature and heat affect it. The MISO CEO says the machine can cook several meals with different recipes simultaneously, removing the need for catering staff.
This technology utilizes a whole bunch of computer vision. There's cameras throughout the system, including right here we have these food identification cameras. The cameras not only guide the robot and tell it exactly where it is in space and how to move through this area, but also identifies the food type and it knows the recipe for each one.
The MISO CEO says tasks like the fry station are the kind that humans are most happy to offload. The name Flippy comes from the original machine designed to flip burgers, which was not very useful for restaurants.
Freedom is an essential virtue that is valued not only by humans but animals as well, just like two eagle owls that have been released into the wild after being born in a Madrid zoo. The two owl twins were freed after months of training to survive in the nature. First, they were taken to a big aviary to develop the necessary skills, including those for hunting prey. The aviary is designed to have a similar environment to the local mountain range. Meantime, they need to gain muscle and come to a suitable weight. After passing various skill tests, the owls are released as part of Madrid Zoo's breeding program of night birds of prey. 7 eagle owls and 11 barn owls have been released since the program was launched in 2017. However, some of them flew back seeking shelter as they failed to adapt to the nature.
Art restoration requires intensive research and training and loads of skill. But imagine the anxiety while professionals embark on restoring rare paintings. Under careful supervision, French restorers are working to give back to 500-year-old paintings their former glory. They were rescued from a fire that engulfed the Notre-Dame Cathedral in Paris in 2019. These works date back from the 17th and early 18th century. The paintings, including 22 with large format, were temporarily stored in a warehouse and now being restored at an undisclosed location. The fire caused strictly no damage to the paintings, but they have accumulated thick layers of dirt and smoke on the surface after hanging in the cathedral for centuries. Some of the works also have paint loss due to overcleaning that restorers say need to be repaired elegantly.
On the outskirts of China's metropolis, Shanghai, a tiny island has been dubbed Cat Island as it provides shelter for stray animals. Since it opened last month, a charity based on the island is taking in cats mainly brought from Shanghai residents. These small carnivorous mammals are neutered and evaluated, and those with good temper and health are allowed to roam free on the island. The city's Stray Cats Management Center says their trap-neuter-release policy is to protect stray cats, limits their population, and maintain ecological balance. However, Shanghai has an estimated 200 stray cats per square kilometer, which means other methods will be needed to control the urban population, stray cats.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The question that has haunted the Brits' minds these days is that whether Rishi Sunak, the new Prime Minister, could handle the looming recession in Britain. This question is answered by experts in different media websites. Stay tuned for the details, please. Global Times wrote, after months of political struggle and economic hardship, Britons are now looking at Rishi Sunak, their third prime minister in 2 months, and the first British Asian prime minister, also one of the richest country ever had. Yet Chinese observers are cautious that he could be the savior of a crisis-laden UK. The recent frequent change of prime ministers in the UK has thrown the country into a once-in-a-generation political turmoil. Although the selection of Sunak offers a momentary relief, experts are warning that Sunak faces several uphill challenges, including saving the crumbling economy and navigating through political headwinds, which if he fails to do, might toss the country into yet another impasse. Sunak has used his first speech as prime minister to warn the UK is in the grips of an economic crisis, as he vowed to fix mistakes made by Liz Truss and win back voters' trust. Addressing the nation recently, Sunak warned there would be difficult decisions to come in an attempt to regain economic stability and avoid mass borrowing mounting up. He was asked by the King at Buckingham Palace to form a government before officially taking power. Sunak, a former chancellor, won the public support of almost 200 of his conservative MP colleagues to succeed Liz Truss, who resigned last Thursday after a chaotic 6 weeks in office. Speaking on Sunak's assuming office, Wang Wenbin, spokesperson of China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, said recently at a press